With all the excitement about anti-PD-1 and various mutations and targeted agents, it's easy to forget that EGFR antibodies, specifically cetuximab, has demonstrated activity in non-small cell lung cancer, and I met with Dr. Roy Herbst, principal investigator of a major phase 3 study evaluating this treatment, and to begin, he talked about the background to this trial.
The question that's still very relevant is, what is the role of cetuximab in non-small cell lung cancer? And, you know, over the years, there have been a number of trials, both in the front and the second line setting. Of course, there's the positive trial, the FLEX trial, that looked at cisplatin vinorelbine with or without cetuximab in over 1,000 patients with advanced metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. That trial was positive for a survival endpoint, but the hazard ratio was not that good. I believe it was 0.89. So the question remains, is there a population of patients who might benefit more from cetuximab, and can we identify them prospectively and treat those patients only? And in the Southwest Oncology Group now, for the last decade, Drs. Gandera, Hirsch, Kelly, Kim, myself, and the others involved in these studies have actually looked quite carefully at cetuximab in combination with chemotherapy. And what we found is those patients who did best in terms of response rate, progression-free, and overall survival were those in whom the copy number of the EGFR gene was 4 or more, as measured by fluorescence in situ hybridization. So it sort of makes sense. If you have more copies of the gene, you're going to make more of the EGFR protein. There'll be more protein on the surface, and presumably those patients are more sensitive to the inhibition by cetuximab. So we did a number of studies in SWOG, including SWOG-0342 and SWOG-0536, and these two studies basically looked at cetuximab with chemotherapy in advanced metastatic lung cancer. And in both cases, it did appear that those patients who had increased gene copy number of the EGFR gene did have an improved outcome with cetuximab.
Now, these are all histologies?
These are all histologies, mixed squamous and adeno, which is nice because it does allow you to include all tumor types. That was important.
And what fraction of the tumors or patients were overexpressed or are?
That's a very good question. Somewhere in the order of 50 to 60% had the overexpression of the EGFR by FISH. I would say 50% is the number that we're looking at as we move forward with the trial. So what we've basically done is we have a large trial, SWOG-0819, on which I am the national PI. And this trial basically is designed to look at that patient population who has FISH positivity for EGFR gene amplification, or should I say, increased copy number. And the way this trial works is patients are enrolled. All patients have to have tissue available at the time of enrollment, and that tissue allows us the ability to measure, among other things, the EGFR copy number by FISH. The patients are then randomized to either carboplatin paclitaxel or carboplatin paclitaxel with cetuximab. The question is being looked at prospectively, but we're not actually stratifying patients based on the marker. We're just making sure that we have the results so that we can look back to see if, in fact, that marker is predictive of outcome. In order to make the trial more user-friendly and to allow physicians to treat patients as they would off-study, bevacizumab is allowed for patients who are considered bevacizumab eligible, which would be those patients who have had no problems with bleeding and have a non-squamous tumor type or brain metastases if they've been treated. So we actually are enrolling that trial, and it's really asking a cetuximab question, but it will have four arms because, you know, we have carboplatin paclitaxel control, carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, another arm of control, and then the two arms that add on the cetuximab. And this trial is being done in SWOG. It's been endorsed by several of the other collaborative groups. It's been in play now for over 3 years, and we have well over 800 patients enrolled. It's accruing at a reasonably rapid clip, and this is an important trial. It's one of the most important ones, I believe, certainly for the role of cetuximab, you know, an EGFR inhibitory antibody in lung cancer.
What is the duration of treatment in the trial?
Well, we treat with the combination of chemotherapy with cetuximab for 6 cycles, and then there's maintenance therapy with cetuximab, which is a bit rigorous. It's given on a weekly basis, which is one of the issues with that drug. Or in the patients who are getting cetuximab, bevacizumab, they would get that with a cetuximab weekly and the bevacizumab every 3 weeks. And then some of the patients will have no maintenance at all if they're on the control arm.
So what have you seen in terms of toxicity, and how long are these people actually on treatment? I would assume the biggest problem would be dermatologic.
It is. Now, this is a randomized phase 3 study. Of course, we know who's getting which drug, but the data have all been seen only by the Data Safety Monitoring Committee. The one thing that we are following very closely, as you can imagine, is toxicity. You know, and the trials continued, and there have been no major issues with severe toxicity leading to any arm being of concern, including the arm, by the way, of carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab, cetuximab. As I'm sure you're aware from some of the studies in colorectal cancer, there were some issues with giving 4 drugs such as that to a patient. So that's good news. And actually, Ed Kim has recently submitted for publication a SWOG study that piloted that combination in 100 patients. So that's good news. As far as, you know, more sort of routine, more irritating type toxicities, yes, skin toxicity is the biggest issue with cetuximab. And it does require some dermatologic management of patients, as is always the case. But that said, I clearly believe from my own work and the work in the laboratory, from some of the investigators here at Yale and at Vanderbilt, that cetuximab is going to have a major role in lung cancer, either in combination with chemotherapy, as we're testing in the SWOG 0819 trial, or from the recent data of cetuximab with afatinib, also known as BIBW2992, the oral irreversible EGFR blocker. Those data are looking quite compelling in refractory patients, either those that have T790M as the reason for their resistance to EGFR inhibitors, or in fact, some of those who do not. That combinations appear to be quite potent. So I do think that we need to continue to look very closely at cetuximab in lung cancer. It's a weapon that we shouldn't discard just because of the limited results from the FLEX study. Of course, there was a great deal of hoopla at the World Lung Conference in Amsterdam now more than a year ago about something called the H score, as I'm sure you remember. And there was some thought that if you look at immunostaining in a more quantitative way, which is all the H score is, it's a way of looking at the intensity of immune staining over the course of the entire tissue section, that did appear to correlate with outcome better. We've added that, by the way, into SWOG 0819, because you always have to be careful when you look retrospectively at a marker from a clinical trial. So the SWOG 0819 trial is an important study, and you know it's important to be on people's radar. It's a cooperative group study now with the groups all working even more closely together than ever before.
On a related vein, what's happening with the combination of cetuximab and afatinib that looked so promising at ASCO 2011?
That was the trial that was led by Laura Horn and colleagues at Vanderbilt, based on the preclinical work from William Powell and Katie Paletti's lab. That trial has now closed in refractory patients, and I know that there are some very intense discussions ongoing right now with our team involved as well to look at follow-on trials for that. And I would say that this combination not only has opportunity in the refractory setting, for sure, but I would also say that I believe that it would have a role in the upfront setting. Because as exciting as it is to treat patients with EGFR inhibitors who have EGFR gene mutations, the reality of the fact is that all patients pretty much will at some point develop resistance. And wouldn't it be great if we could target with our most potent combination from the get-go? And certainly afatinib has that possibility, although the trial that was done for afatinib was versus chemotherapy, so that doesn't tell us that it's any better than erlotinib. But the idea of afatinib, cetuximab, getting that ready to go as a frontline combination, assuming that patients can tolerate the dual skin toxicity, which will be something that will need to be worked on, I think makes a lot of sense. And that's something that's being discussed quite extensively around the country now among investigators in this area.
I hope something gets done on that fast, because I tell you, one of the most common questions we get, I don't have to tell you, is what do I do with the patient with an EGFR mutation who has a great response to erlotinib and then progresses? I mean, granted what you're saying, I mean, maybe eventually something like this is going to be used up front, but that waterfall plot was pretty impressive that they showed a year plus ago, and it'd be nice to be able to at least have trials you could put a patient on.
Right, and I'll tell you that William Powell, Katie Paletti, and others are both moving this forward clinically, because the clinical results, I agree with you, are so compelling that no matter what the mechanism, this should move forward. But it's also important to figure out exactly what the mechanism is behind this effect. And there's a great deal of work being done in transgenic mouse models of lung cancer with these different mutations, because I think if we can figure out exactly why it's working, in which patients it's working, it can even be more effective.
Yeah, and I guess the other caveat to this, because, you know, people naturally would say, well, yeah, afatinib's not approved, But what about erlotinib and cetuximab? And my understanding is, at least the laboratory basis and maybe clinically, it doesn't seem to be as effective.
No, not at all. There were some mathematical models that suggested that combination at one time, and they were studied, but both in the lab and the clinic, they're not nearly as effective. So it's not just combining EGFR targeting from the outside and the inside. No, I think that might be part of it, but it really speaks specifically to something about the afatinib. And, you know, afatinib targets a number of receptors, HER1, HER2, HER3, so maybe that has a role as well.
Also that it's irreversible. I don't know how much difference that makes.
That allows it to work in the T790M population. And perhaps that's more common than we think. Afatinib was designed so that it would work in the active pocket in patients who have the T790M mutation. So what you get with afatinib, at least the way I understand it, is you get activity in T790M resistant patients, which is about 50% of them, but you also have activity against some of the other EGFR receptor subtypes. I will tell you, if you recall, the initial study that was done, I believe led by Vincent Miller, that looked at, I think it was called LUX-Lung-1, that looked at afatinib versus placebo in refractory patients, had an amazing response rate and a very high progression-free survival in patients who didn't have documented T790M mutation. They were all patients who had been on erlotinib and responded and then failed. So the presumption was a large majority of them had T790M. But the problem was, in that trial, if I recall, there wasn't any survival benefit seen over the long haul, which was a bit hard to explain. But clearly, we know that afatinib does have activity in patients who have resistance based on T790M, which is going to be at least 50% of the mechanism of resistance, at least from what we know now.
You were involved with the BATTLE trial program when you were at MD Anderson. Can you provide an update on that program now that you moved to Yale?
We did studies when I was at MD Anderson, and now actually we have them open here at Yale, known as the BATTLE trial. And in the BATTLE trial, we actually are treating with erlotinib, and we actually did find from the first BATTLE study that there were a series of genes, a profile, that could tell us in the wild-type EGFR patient who would do well, meaning they would have more long-term stable disease, versus who might progress immediately. And Ignacio Astuba, John Hamak, Pierre Santangi, and others in the group actually are preparing to publish now this five-gene signature, which they call the wild-type erlotinib EGFR signature. So here we actually have a series of genes that might be predictive. But all these things take time. You can generate a hypothesis from these tissue-based studies, and then you can look at these tissue signatures and see if you can then look at it prospectively in other trials. And actually, that's what we're doing with our BATTLE program. In our first BATTLE-1 trial, we generated some of these signatures, for example, for erlotinib. And in the BATTLE-2 program, which actually is enrolling patients now at Yale. It took me a year since I left MD Anderson, but we're now open and accruing here at Yale. One of the things we're going to look at is, can we use some of these signatures prospectively to help us sort the patients more effectively? Because we're in a world now where personalized medicine is critical. We know that these agents, if they are targeted therapies, of course they're only going to work in certain populations. And some of these signatures, whether they be protein at the level of RNA and RNA expression, even mutations, are going to be critical.
I mean, I should mention, too, I think most people know that the BATTLE trial that you and Ed Kim pioneered in MD Anderson, to me, the key thing was that you got tissue, core tissue, and you utilized that in the protocol. And I think it set the precedent for that whole thing, not just in lung cancer, but beyond that kind of approach. But even though you all, it was great that you proved that you could get the tissue, you're still talking about a core biopsy. That if you find you can do it, but you can't necessarily do it that often.
Absolutely. The core biopsies that are part of the BATTLE program, actually, they're, as the word's getting out and people are becoming more comfortable with it, we're now in the BATTLE 2 program getting 5 cores through a CT-guided procedure. The thing that's actually quite interesting is, with the help of Ignacio Astuba and the team at MD Anderson, we've actually started doing the exact same procedure here at Yale. So that makes me hopeful that the same sort of procedure can now be exported around the country. But you're absolutely right, Neil. It would be nice if we could get something from the blood, something that we could get even more frequently. We can look at both pre- and post-treatment that would allow us to understand how a therapy is working. If we could look at proteins in the blood, if we could look at DNA in the blood, if we could look at circulating tumor cells, circulating endothelial cells, these are all very important things that are in the research setting right now, but critical to obtain in any trial. Because I'll tell you, it's not only the biopsy anymore. You know, times have changed. You're right. When Ed and Ki Hong and our group at MD Anderson first started to do the BATTLE studies, we were very pleased we could get one biopsy before we treated patients, a real-time biopsy. Now we're all talking about the rebiopsy. So the key thing that's been set up here at Yale by Katie Paletti and Scott Gettinger, my colleagues, and it's running at many centers, is when someone progresses, that's when you have to get another biopsy, because that biopsy is going to tell you, why is the patient progressing? Why are they resistant? So that can help you both practically for the patient, and of course, if you get to stick a needle into someone, it's nice to tell them that this information is going to help us figure out what to do for you next. But also in a research setting now, we can look for new pathways of resistance. And we're into an era now of deep sequencing. I'm sure you saw just recently, there were 5 papers that came out looking at next-gen sequencing of lung cancer, including the squamous cell results from the TCGA, the massive project sponsored by the NCI to look at the lung cancer tumor genome. And it's becoming more and more commonplace now to look at many genes in a lung tumor and try to figure out what to give the patient based on that. And the key thing now is going to be to develop enough clinical trials with some of the drugs we're talking about, using them in the right setting. And it's going to require centers to work together, because we're going to really have to be very focused on which pathways we target and which drug or drug combinations we use.
Another concern that comes up is heterogeneity within tumors. And again, if you have a serum assay, to some extent, that seems like it would get around that. But what do we know if you do multiple simultaneous assays in the same patient of different sites or different tumors? Does it tend to be the same?
Yes and no. You're absolutely right. There have been some major reports, not in lung cancer so much, but there was a major paper in the New England Journal of Medicine not too long ago out of England that looked at renal tumors and biopsied in multiple sites and found very different gene signatures in different parts of the tumor. And clearly we know about the seed and the soil, and that there's going to be different genes expressed depending on what the tumor is next to, you know, the blood vessels, the stroma. What I think is probably going to be the case, and this is my opinion, is that the major mutations will probably be consistent, you know, an EGFR driver mutation and ALK translocations. But there might be other minor gene changes or changes in expression, which are going to vary depending on where you biopsy in the tumor. So it does create a whole nother level of variability and the need for caution. So it is something that needs to be considered as we're doing these really small biopsies. You know, some say that that might be a reason to use the blood and to either use circulating tumor cells or to use whatever you can measure in the blood, because if it gets to the blood, that might tell you that it's come from the most aggressive, most metastatic cells. That's a good theory, and I think it makes some sense. But clearly, we're going to need more and more studies where we get large resections of a lung, and then we also have had core biopsies or serum studies as well to try to correlate those smaller biopsies or blood-based studies with what's present in the larger tumor.
What has been done before? What do we know about proteomics in the blood in general and lung cancer and outside of it? It seems like something you would think has been looked at a lot, or has it?
It's being looked at. You know, we looked at it in our battle studies. Most of our work was looking at the proteins in the tumor, but there are groups now looking at it in the blood. There are a number of companies out there that are actually have tests just in that way to measure protein proteomic profiles in the blood and correlate that with outcome. I've seen reports that actually, at a meeting I organized not too long ago for the ASCO and ISLAC, there were some presentations of a serum proteomic profile that could tell you who had lung cancer and who didn't. So you can imagine there might be profiles like that that could help you with early diagnosis. That would be important, especially in this era of screening. Our center and others are now screening for lung cancer in patients who have smoked. You know, based on the NLST study, that's patients who have smoked 30 or more pack years of smoking. But I can tell you every once in a while, someone slips in who's had a bit less. If we can develop techniques to try to determine if we do find something on one of these CTs, how likely it is to be a cancer, and if we can measure something in the blood, I think that would be an outstanding advance. So all of these things are in the research setting. The good news is that the world is so focused now on tissue for patients with lung cancer. Almost every patient is getting at least the opportunity to have their tumor profiled. So now, for those of us like myself who work in the large universities, who are investigators with the cooperative groups, we need to develop studies where we are obtaining blood and we're trying to pair that blood with the proper tests. It's a challenge, but it's an exciting one.
Let's talk about your cases, beginning with your 42-year-old man presenting with advanced disease.
So one case that struck me recently was a young man, about 42 years old, who had smoked very little. He had smoked a little bit in his teens, who came in with a metastatic lung cancer picture. Performance status was quite good. What we do now is we routinely send these patients tumors for tumor profiling. We have a profiling center here at Yale. And we actually test for 66 different genes that we know are critical or could have some influence on our treatment in lung cancer. But realistically, the ones that are most relevant are ALK and EGFR.
But you did that on this man?
We did that on this man.
How long does it take to get the results back?
About a week.
You said he was kind of clinically stable. Where was his metastatic disease?
Well, he had bilateral disease in his lungs, and he also had some metastases to his liver.
He had a core biopsy done, obviously. Of what location?
The biopsy was done from his lung. The biopsy was actually done by an EBUS procedure. Here in New Haven, actually, the patients, when they usually present to the internist and then to the pulmonologist, the group here is very, very skilled in EBUS, and they get actually pretty large biopsies from an EBUS procedure. And in some ways, that's even less invasive than the core biopsies that we've been doing.
I don't know about that. I mean, it kind of sounds like it'd be more uncomfortable for the patient.
Yes and no, but in some cases, you need to do a bronchoscopy anyhow.
Right.
So at least it's being done as part of the initial procedure. But you're right, it's a 50-50 type of...
Yeah, but I mean, if you're going to have a bronchoscopy, then okay, that makes sense.
Right. In the old days, it was easier in that, you know, the bronchoscopy was usually done and it was covered by insurance. But these days, more and more insurers are covering the biopsies as well, realizing how critical these are for lung cancer, which I'm very happy to see.
Did he have mediastinal adenopathy on CAT scan?
He had some. He had on both sides, some with PET scan, some evidence of N2 disease.
Because that's the other thing would be also the issue of the yield. Do you usually need to see, you know, adenopathy, significant adenopathy, in order to feel comfortable you're going to get enough tissue?
You usually would want to, on the PET scan, see something. But this fellow was having some shortness of breath. That was his initial presentation with some infiltrate in his lung. So he ended up having a bronch, and that's how his diagnosis was made.
No pleural effusion?
No pleural effusion.
So what did the 66 gene thing show?
He was negative for RAS mutation, for EGFR. But we do FISH to look for ALK translocation. And he did have a typical ALK anaplastic lymphoma kinase translocation. So this man, you know, was one of the 3 to 5% of patients who have ALK translocated non-small cell lung cancer. Brain scan was done. Brain scan was negative. He had an MRI. In someone like this, the frontline therapy that I would use is crizotinib. So we actually treated him with crizotinib. It was not long after the drug had become approved, so we could get it off of clinical trial. Just remarkable. I've been doing, I guess, lung cancer therapy for almost 20 years. And it's great when you can see someone who's, you know, got a bit short of breath. You know, their breathing gets better. You do scans within a month to 6 weeks, and the tumors are just melting away. So that was the case here. And that's been my experience with crizotinib and the selected patients, that you see response in about 80%.
So you started crizotinib, then what happened?
Well, he actually sailed through. He was working, he was exercising, he was enjoying life with his family. He did incredibly well. The problem is, around 6 to 7 months in, he came in, and on routine rescanning, we scanned him with a PET scan, so a total body PET scan, and we also did a brain scan, because that's what I do usually every 6 months, and he developed metastases to the brain. I can tell you that, unfortunately, this is something, again, with my large experience, but my experience is not just my experience, it's that of a whole center. I actually have oncologists working with me who are much more busy than me now, since I'm the chief of the section, and I can tell you that this is just so common with crizotinib. You see it with erlotinib too, that you do a great job with the systemic disease, but you do see the brain as a site where, for whatever reason, probably because the levels of drug in the brain are not high enough, that these patients will, and the drug's not crossing into the brain through the blood-brain barrier, that you are seeing patients with refractory metastases there.
So this patient, what was going on with the rest of the disease outside the brain?
The rest of the disease was still responding.
Partial response?
Yeah, it was good partial response.
No new lesions anywhere else?
No new lesions. And I've seen that more than once now, you know, again, in a limited experience. So that's something I think we're seeing more and more now with these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. We're seeing that the brain disease, you know, it's not unexpected that someone who started out with such a large volume of disease, both lungs, liver, would have metastases to the brain. You know, 25 to 30% of patients with lung cancer will have brain metastases, and it's always been a source of great morbidity. So what do you do with someone like this? He had 2 or 3 small areas of the brain. I go to radiology myself. You look at them with a radiologist, and clearly these are brain metastases. He's asymptomatic. He's taking his crizotinib every day. He feels great. So this is the type of thing that you deal with.
And what are you thinking of doing?
So on someone like this, I try, you know, if they're having an active lifestyle, I try to avoid whole brain radiation if I can. And again, you know, I practice in a center, and I'm sure many do these days, where I can go right down to the neurosurgeon and the radiation oncologist who are working in a gamma knife center, and we look at his films. And since they can't be too big or too small to do these gamma knife, you know, these procedures, it was felt that since he only had a couple of lesions, he'd be a candidate for that. So what I basically did is we held the crizotinib, we treated him with a gamma knife, which of course is just a single day's treatment, waited a few weeks, and then we restarted him back on his crizotinib. And, you know, you're tempted to go to another agent because there are drugs now. There are second-generation ALK inhibitors from a number of different companies, agents that are working both in the refractory disease systemically. But there are some rumors that they might be better at penetrating the blood-brain barrier. I'm not convinced of that yet. But my feeling was stick with the crizotinib as long as we can.
I was wondering, what else could you do systemically? Because, you know, kind of doesn't sound like it's going to be a great situation for a very long 42-year-old man. I mean, I guess I've got anti-PD-1 on the brain because I just spent an hour with Julie Brainwer. But, I mean, are there trials that you could get him on with anti-PD-1?
We could. Probably the first thing I would do, and you're talking to the converted here because our clinic here at Yale is half the trials are either anti-PD-1 or anti-ALK. But I would probably try to switch him to another ALK inhibitor, which we're using with some success. So I'd probably switch him to one of these trials. And these trials are meant for this type of patient. You know, I couldn't guarantee him that it would be active in the brain. That's why I would do local control first. But I think with time, we'll probably learn, you know, whether these next generation inhibitors do in fact work in the brain. But you're right. We're talking about, you know, finding a drug for a target, then using another drug if the target becomes resistant. But, you know, the PD-1 story is just phenomenal. And the idea that you can use the body's own immune system by unleashing it, by using an antibody against PD-1 or against PD-1 ligand, I think is quite compelling. You know, if you look at those studies, the response rates were reasonable, you know, 10-18%, something in that range. But then if you look, a lot of those patients in lung cancer were treated with lower doses of the drug. So if you look at the dose that's gone forward, which I believe is a 3 mg/kg, it does look like the response rates will be in the 20-30% range. It's still very early.
They've also got those spider diagrams that are fascinating in terms of, you know, seems like there's some patients who do really well for a long period of time. Your colleague Tom Lynch has been all excited about this for a while, but my whole view of this changed at ASCO, and again, talking to Julie was informative. And I, without getting into the whole thing, the one thing that I was curious what your thoughts were, of course, we have to find the trials, but I mean, why couldn't you be doing an immune-based therapy like anti-PD-1, particularly because it seems to be well-tolerated, at the same time that you're doing sort of oncogene addiction treatment?
You know what? You definitely should do that, because the whole beauty of that is that something like a PD-1 is probably going to have a bit of a lag, you know, because no matter how good it is, when you're getting the immune system revved up, it's going to take some time. But the thing that is quite interesting about anti-PD-1 therapy is the durability. So you give both at the same time. So you give erlotinib, you give crizotinib to an EGFR mutated or an ALK translocated patient with the PD-1 right from the get-go. It's a perfect idea because here you'll have the 70-80% response from those small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and most patients are symptomatic and they desperately need that response. The case that I discussed with you was someone who came in with good performance status, but you know, on a different day, I might have told you about a 65-year-old woman who can hardly walk and she's about to be intubated and you give her the drug and she gets better as well. But again, everyone, no matter how they start, is going to ultimately become refractory. So wouldn't it be great if you could target the immune system at the same time and then you could have that for the long-term more durable effect and the tyrosine kinase inhibitor early on? We're actually trying now to do studies just like that. It's a great idea. We're modeling it actually right now in our animal models. Here at Yale, we actually have Li-Ping Chen. Dr. Chen is an immunologist. He actually is the person who first described B7H1, also known as PD-1 ligand, which Julie Brainwer and colleagues showed at ASCO, did appear to correlate, Dr. Topalian, did appear to correlate with activity of the PD-1 approach. So we are actually in animal models here at Yale looking at that very idea. Can you target EGFR-mutated disease both with erlotinib and the PD-1. And I think that clinically that's going to be very important as well.
Yeah, it's been really dizzying with some of the discussions, not just in lung, but, you know, melanoma. If you think about it, vemurafenib or the new one, dabrafenib, BRAF inhibitor, PD-1, again, the same kind of concept. Do you hit the oncogene addiction, but maybe think about stimulating the immune system, renal, TKI, and PD-1? I don't know.
Oh, absolutely. And let me just throw something else out there because it's on my mind because I'm, you know, we're very excited about this in our research. Is it as interesting as it is that 20 to 30% of lung cancer patients are responding to PD-1 therapy, I still must ask, what about those other 70%? Because we're biopsying disease both at the initial treatment of PD-1 and we're also biopsying at the refractory setting, we're doing re-biopsies, we're now learning that there are all sorts of different ways that tumors get around this PD-1 therapy. In some cases, the T cells never even come to the tumor. So that's interesting because perhaps we could develop a combination therapy with a PD-1 with some sort of immune cytokine so that we can actually try to bring the T cells into the tumor, the TIL cells, so to speak. So there are all sorts of ways that I think this PD-1 can be enhanced. So I think it's opened up a whole new area. And I can tell you, here at Yale in our lung program, one of our major projects is with Liping Chen and Scott Gettinger and others looking at this PD-1.
Yeah, I'm the eternal skeptic, but even I'm excited, and I got a feeling there are a lot of other people out there. Maybe we can finish out talking about the other patient who presented with stage 4 triple-negative lung cancer.
So 80% of what I see in my practice is this, because I'm a specialist on new drugs and predictive markers. So I see mostly in my practice now patients with advanced disease, either untreated or previously treated. So if someone comes in untreated with stage 4 disease, smoker or non-smoker, I still send their tissue off right away. In fact, the instructions are from the time the patient makes the new patient appointment, and they'll get their slides, get it cooking even before we see them. If someone is EGFR wild type, ALK wild type, ROS wild type, RAS wild type, or even if they're RAS mutated, because you know we really don't have a therapy to target KRAS right now, that would be a patient who we're going to be giving chemotherapy. So what we do here at Yale, and since I'm the primary investigator on the SWOG-0819 trial, I put most of these patients on SWOG-0819, which is carboplatin paclitaxel with or without cetuximab. There's also the bevacizumab option in that trial. So if the patient's bevacizumab eligible, meaning they have non-squamous tumor and they have no bleeding issues, they can get bevacizumab. So that's pretty much been what I've been doing here and at all of our satellite sites. We have 24 doctors in our practice that are working, you know, within 35 miles of Yale. Now, that said, you know, I'm always looking for new protocols and new approaches. I think that right now, chemotherapy plus a PI3 kinase inhibitor is something that looks rather attractive, and there are some trials there.
Let me ask you, let's say a patient like that is not eligible or interested in the SWOG or any other trial, what would tend to be your non-protocol strategy?
Well, off protocol, I typically would, for the adenocarcinoma patients, I would either give them carboplatin paclitaxel or carboplatin pemetrexed.
How do you decide between the two?
Well, normally if they're interested in bevacizumab, I would probably give carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab. If they'd rather not have bevacizumab, I usually give carboplatin pemetrexed without bevacizumab. And actually, I was waiting for the results of the Point Break trial, but those don't really seem to support using pemetrexed.
So what about maintenance in that situation? How do you approach that?
You know, I'm not a big fan of maintenance. I know the data, but in the non-squamous patient, for example, I probably would not use maintenance. What I would normally do is I would treat patients for 4 or 6 cycles, depending on how they're tolerating it, and I would stop. And again, this is just, you know, the way I practice. I would watch and wait and give patients a break. And then at the time that they become refractory, and of course they will, unfortunately, then I would put them on a second-line trial. I have the BATTLE trial available and a number of other approaches that I do. The BATTLE trial has a couple of interesting arms to it, including sorafenib, including MK2206, which is an AKT inhibitor, plus AZD6244, which is a MEK inhibitor. So we have a couple of very interesting arms of that that I would offer a patient. But I don't typically do maintenance in my practice, though I know many others do.
Yeah, I was going to say that we are fans of trying to quantitate what people do just by asking them. And as you said, actually, your statement, I would say if we were to ask 20 investigators on lung cancer, pretty few of them would say that what you just said. You know, most of them seem to use some type of maintenance. And one of the concerns has been that just following patients, they can slip away from you before ever even getting second-line therapy or get too sick before that happens.
Right. Now, I think that that's a concern. You have a window of opportunity and you don't want to miss it. For my druthers, I'd much rather treat someone maximally with chemotherapy and then at the time that they progress, re-biopsy them, understand why they're progressing. The other thing, by the way, that I didn't mention, the other trials that we are running here for frontline are trials with PD-1 approaches.
I'm curious, what are the designs of the studies?
Well, you know, the designs have become these octopus designs because they're trying to account for every possibility. But the most standard trial is standard chemotherapy, carbopaclitaxel, carbogem, with PD-1. These are early phase studies just looking at the toxicity.
With it.
Yeah, you can imagine that there are all sorts of questions that come up.
Yeah.
Do you give the PD-1 before? Do
right.
you give it after? Do you give it during? You know, you worry about using steroids and other drugs which might mute the immune response, but that's all being piloted right now. And then there are approaches similar to what we talked about earlier, where there is an arm for the EGFR mutated patient, for example. This is a trial, for example, where the patient was EGFR mutated and sensitive, and then they become refractory. There you use the EGFR inhibitor erlotinib plus PD-1. So there are approaches like that being tested. So these are early phase trials, and in early phase trials, you're just trying to get experience. In the refractory setting, you know, which is even more common in someone who's negative for all markers, I think the trials that will become very important will be the trials of chemotherapy versus PD-1. You know, there'll be one in squamous and non-squamous tumors.
You know, this issue of steroids is something I've heard about before, even as it relates to ipilimumab. And, you know, the obvious question, as you say, is it going to interfere with immune kind of strategies? I was kind of wondering whether or not, you know, since taxanes and particularly paclitaxel seems so integral to lung cancer right now, whether or not nab-paclitaxel is something that people are thinking more about in some of these immune studies. And I saw some stuff came out in Chicago related to nab. Where is that now and where is it heading anywhere?
All these nab-paclitaxel or there are other taxane formulations, you know, that have been brought forward, less toxic, avoid the cremophore and so forth. I don't know. In the absence of any truly improved benefit, I think it's going to be a hard sell to add that into lung cancer regimens. Unless, of course, you know, as you say, it's going to make a difference with a PD-1 approach because you don't want to give the steroids. That's an interesting thought. I had never considered that until you just mentioned it, but I think that hits a chord with me that would perhaps make me consider using it if I were designing a new trial.
Well, actually, that wasn't my original thought. That was your colleague down the hall, Tom Lynch's thought. He actually mentioned that to me. And that's why I found it curious or interesting that in these PD-1 chemo trials, you know, you're really going to give them steroids.
Right. And that's being debated. And I think the only way to do this will be to really have pharmacodynamic markers of response and to know who's responding and why and to biopsy patients before, during, and after. And actually, that's a large part of what we're doing here. Tom, myself, Scott Gettinger, and Liping Shin, the group at Yale, where we're trying to run these trials with these PD-1 approaches where we are looking at the tissue and the blood to try to figure these things out. Because there are the number of variables, as in most oncology studies, can escalate quickly.